Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. I'm Jason.
And I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
And we have an awesome show for you today. Kevin, what's on the OR schedule?
Yeah, we're really excited to have Dr. Kelly Hunt of MD Anderson in Houston, Texas. She's chief of the breast surgical oncology, and she's going to talk to us today about the changing paradigm of breast cancer and the new approaches to managing the axilla.
Yeah, I just want to remind everybody out there that you need to hit us up and use all of our social media platforms out there. We're available on Twitter at Behind the Knife. We're available on the web at www.behindtheknife.org. And also available on iTunes and other Droid ones. Now, it's very important. You need to hit subscribe out there, but also interact with us. Let us know who you want us to talk to, what you want us to questions to ask these particular people. And don't forget about, tell us your random fact of the day.
Yeah, a little bit later, we're going to get into the random fact with a little bit of history about breast cancer. But first, our opening shot.
Okay, for today's opening shot, we're going to talk very briefly about breast cancer. Obviously, this is a very big topic of conversation that could last hours in itself, but we're just going to hit a few high points. So, Jay, tell us a little bit about the background about breast cancer and some of the risk factors for these patients.
Yeah, okay. So, breast cancer is the most common cancer in American women and second most common cause of cancer death. Over 180,000 cases of breast cancer per year are seen in the United States, with over 41,000 deaths. Some of the risk factors associated with breast cancer: age. As a person gets older, their risk of breast cancer goes up. In fact, half of the lifetime risk occurs after the age of 65. Family history, personal history of breast cancer, or some of the benign lesions like DCIS and LCIS, and a lifetime exposure to estrogen, such as early menarche, late menopause, not having any children, and postmenopausal obesity. The Gale model is the clinical tool used frequently to kind of assess an individual's risk and predict their risk of developing breast cancer.
Yeah, that's something that can be often found on any app or just kind of Google it online. Mm-hmm. Kevin, when we talk about benign or pre-malignant lesions, the two major ones that stick out are the LCS, the lobular carcinoma in situ, as well as the DCIS. Tell me a little bit about lobular carcinoma in situ.
Yeah, so that one, it's a marker. It is not a pre-malignant lesion itself. And it's a marker for bilateral breast cancer. It is not indicative of which side will get cancer. You need to resect the suspicious area, but you do not need negative margins. And you have about a 1% per year risk of developing breast cancer in either breast. Some evidence to support hormonal therapy to decrease risk, but really just need careful surveillance. And then for the special patient, you can consider a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy as an option.
And then something that often comes up with LCIS is that, it being a marker for breast cancer, what's the most common type of breast cancer that is that pops up with it?
It's a ductal.
Okay. And so, Jay, DCIS in itself, a little bit of high points on that?
Yeah, DCIS, on the other hand, is considered a pre-malignant lesion. Typically found on mammography as clustered microcalcifications is the most frequent way it is presented. As far as treatment, you need to resect these. You can, depending on a couple different factors, you can go with mastectomy versus breast conservation therapy. They've been shown to have equal survival, but there is a higher local recurrence rate with the breast conservation therapy. The addition of radiation therapy to a lumpectomy decreases the local recurrence by about 50%, and that often comes up. That's out of the NSABP 17 trial. Overall, there's about a 10 to 15% chance of local recurrence with breast conservation therapy plus XRT. Some of the different hormonal therapies, such as tamoxifen, can reduce the risk of all breast cancer events in ER-positive lesions found to be DCIS. And axillary sampling with either sentinel lymph node or axillary dissection with DCIS is not required, but if the patient is undergoing a mastectomy for that DCIS, it should be considered.
Yeah, and so switching gears now to malignant type lesions, there's a couple of different ones out there. Kevin, what's the breakdown of those?
So by far and away, the most common is the infiltrating ductal carcinoma. This is 65 to 80% of breast cancer. About 10% of breast cancer is the infiltrating lobular carcinoma, and this is important to remember that this has a high rate of bilateral disease. The presence of LCIS increases the risk of bilateral disease, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah, that's something that often shows up on tests, the bilaterality, which one of the following is type that, so typically the infiltrating lobular carcinoma. So, Kevin, there's a couple of different mutations out there that put us at higher risk for these. Can the BRCA genes, the BRCA mutations, can you tell us a little bit about that and the estimated lifetime cancer risk for both BRCA1 and BRCA2?
Right. So BRCA really only encompasses about 5 to 10% of breast cancers. And you should suspect this in a patient if they have two or more relatives affected with early onset breast or ovarian cancer with involvement of two or more generations. So they differ a little bit, BRCA1 and BRCA2, in which cancers are most common to get. The breast cancer risk is about 40 to 85% in BRCA1 and BRCA2, compared to 8% in the general population in your lifetime of getting breast cancer.
Yeah, those similar ones are also this similar in terms of developing contralateral breast cancer for BRCA1 and BRCA2, again, about 40 to 65% versus the general population, which is much lower, down an order of less than 1%. Jay, is this women alone for this BRCA1, BRCA2?
No, there's other associations with both these lesions. When you think about the BRCA1, you're really thinking about an increased risk of ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. With both BRCA1 and BRCA2, you do have an increased risk of ovarian cancer, but it's really the BRCA1 that carries up to a 30 to 45% chance of developing ovarian cancer. With BRCA2, in response to your question, those are the ones that are more commonly seen in men and male breast cancer. So if you have a male breast cancer, there's a pretty high likelihood that there's a BRCA2 gene responsible for it.
So, Kevin, for screening for these particular patients who do have the BRCA1, BRCA2, what is the recommended need for screening, and what are the modalities that we use? So, you know, they talk about different ones. What is that?
They need an annual breast MRI starting at about age 25, and they also need yearly pelvic exams and ultrasounds with yearly CA125 looking for ovarian cancer.
Jake, is there anything that we can do? Let's say you got a person that says that they don't necessarily want to undergo all this intensive surveillance screening type stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something you need to have a conversation with the patient about, and it's something where there really is a role for prophylactic surgery with a bilateral mastectomy, which will decrease your risk of breast cancer, but also the associated cancers, the ovarian cancers, with performing a total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. Those surgeries together reduce the risk of development of these cancers by 95%.
When we take a step back and we talk about tumor biology as well, as it just seems like there's no more prevalent cancer out there that really, in terms of treatment, has some hormonal therapy to it. Can you touch very quickly on hormonal therapy for these patients, Kevin?
Right. So all breast cancers are tested to see if they're hormone responsive, and there's the ER and PR, which respond to tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors depending on your age. And then there's also the HER2 gene. This is a recent proto-oncogene that was recognized, and they've developed Herceptin, which actually targets this.
Very quickly about surgery, Kevin, since this is the surgery podcast, take me very quickly through first preoperative staging workup in these patients and then the surgical management of invasive carcinoma.
Right. So you want to do a standard preoperative staging, including a chest x-ray and LFTs. And then you can consider a CT onc if advanced disease or suspicious findings on your labs or chest x-ray. And then if you have a patient complaining of any bone pain, a bone scan would be something to consider. And then obviously if any neurosymptoms, you consider a head CT.
Jay, surgical management of invasive carcinoma?
Sure. So the surgical management of breast cancer is really dependent upon the stage. For early stage disease, you know, stage 1, 2, and even stage 3 disease, your options are either mastectomy versus breast conservation therapy with radiation. It's been shown that there's no difference in survival between mastectomy and breast conservation therapy. Again, you do have a higher recurrence rate with breast conservation. With breast conservation, there's a number of things. You need a 1 centimeter margin. The axillary sampling with sentinel lymph node for patients with clinically negative axilla. If clinically positive, those patients should undergo a full axillary dissection. And postoperatively, adjuvant therapy with TAC therapy, or the taxanes, adriamycin, and cyclophosphamide, is generally used. And XRT following the chemotherapy. And then from that, based on your hormonal status, you have your adjuvants of tamoxifen and Herceptin. Now, it's important when you're trying to consider between a breast conservation and mastectomy, there are some contraindications that are out there to proceeding with a breast conserving approach. Multicentric disease, previous XRT, positive margins with re-excision, the tumor size in relation to the size of the breast, some of your autoimmune diseases like scleroderma may prevent you from doing a breast conservation therapy because they can't handle the radiation, and as well as inflammatory breast cancer.
Yeah, and for the locally advanced disease, the tumors that are stage T4, you'd consider doing neoadjuvant therapy, which would allow downstaging, and at that point you could continue on with either breast conservation therapy or to mastectomy. And then with the advanced stages with the metastatic disease, this is generally non-operable and treated with palliative chemotherapy.
And certainly one of the more interesting and evolving fields with regard to the surgical treatment of breast cancer is the treatment of the axilla. We know from the Z11 trial that at least in some group of patients that have a low axillary burden, they do not benefit from the addition of an axillary lymph node when combined with whole breast radiation and systemic therapy. Now, these were looking at patients who had a clinically negative axilla, underwent sentinel lymph node, and maybe had micrometastasis or a low burden within the axilla. This is important because the axillary dissection does carry with it a increased risk of morbidity or an increased morbidity, and it's quite a morbid procedure. That led to looking at if there were a way of decreasing this morbidity in patients who had clinically positive axillas. And Kevin, why don't you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, yeah, so that's the Z1071 trial. I have to say that the breast oncologists aren't very creative with their names of trials. But the Z1071 trial wanted to take patients that were node positive and then underwent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. They then took these patients and did a sentinel lymph node on them, followed by an axillary lymph node dissection to see what the false negative rate would be when these patients were downstaged with the chemo radiation therapy. They actually enrolled 656 women in this, and what they showed was that in 39 of the patients, cancer was not identified in the sentinel lymph node, but was found in the lymph nodes obtained with the axillary lymph node dissection, resulting in a false negative rate of 12.6%, which was not, their goal was to have the false negative rate to be under 10%. So with this, the false negative rate was higher than they had anticipated, so they cannot recommend any changes to current practice as far as patients with positive, clinically positive nodes. But it was interesting nonetheless.
Yes, you know, so this all goes into just trying to decrease the morbidity associated with the axillary dissection. And, you know, what patients, does this really change local regional control or overall survival? And, you know, this is an ongoing area of debate. And it has led into the development of new techniques, you know, such as the targeted axillary node dissection with use of ultrasound and other mapping techniques. And this is kind of really on the forefront of where the surgical treatment of breast cancer is currently. So we're going to talk about these trials and the surgical management of the axilla a little bit more in detail with our guest today, Dr. Hunt, in our dissection of the day. Okay, well, you know what that music means. It's time for our random fact of the day.
Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about breast cancer, and we've all heard about Halstead and George Crile and the modern treatments of breast cancer and breast-conserving therapy, but let's go way, way, way back. Let's go back to the ancient times. Ancient Egyptians were the first to note the disease more than 3,500 years ago. As a matter of fact, Edwin Smith and George Ebers on papyri, described the descriptions of bulging tumors of the breast that have no cure. But Jay, it didn't end there, did it?
It did not. So Hippocrates, who is known as the father of Western medicine, in 460 BC described breast cancer as a humoral disease. He postulated that the body consists of four humors.
Let me guess, blood, phlegm, yellow, and black bile.
That's exactly right. He suggested that cancer was caused by excess of black bile. In the appearance of breast cancer, it appeared to be dark, black, hard tumors that burst forth, and if left untreated, yielded a black fluid. He named the cancer carcinos, the Greek word for crab, because the tumor seemed to have tentacles like the legs of a crab.
I'm guessing it didn't end there, though, Kevin.
No, about 600 years later, in the year 200, Galen described it, the cancer as well. He also thought it was related to black bile like Hippocrates, but he thought that some of the tumors were more dangerous than others. So he suggested actually some of the first treatments, which were opium, castor oil, licorice, sulfur. But because they thought it was a completely systemic disease, they still weren't using surgery to treat this disease.
So very briefly, fast forward to the 17th century when Galen's theories on breast cancer were believed for a very long time. And it really wasn't until the 1700s when they started to say that it was not black bile, that in, as a matter of fact, it was due to other conditions, and that the systemic theory of Galen was really started to be rejected around the 1730s. Now, Jay, in 1757, there was Henri Ladron. What was his major contribution?
Well, his major contribution was he suggested that surgical removal or resection could help treat breast cancer.
So, again, he also said that as long as the lymph nodes of the armpits were removed, and
yeah,
again,
it's crazy, 1700s. Yeah.
1700s, which gave us our starts of our radical mastectomy that were followed for a long time. And really, this lasted well into the 20th century and led to the creation of the radical mastectomy or extensive removal of the breast. And that has been your random fact of the day. So, welcome to Behind the Knife. We are very pleased today to have Dr. Kelly Hunt join us. She is a professor in the Department of Surgical Oncology and the Division of Surgery at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and she's also the Chief of Breast Surgical Oncology Section within the Department of Surgical Oncology. Dr. Hunt, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So, you were recently appointed the Director of the ACS Clinical Research Program by the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology. Can you tell the listeners out there a little bit more about this program and how you got involved in it?
Yes, so this program was something that was recently developed. It's a brand new program that is a collaboration between the American College of Surgeons, the Commission on Cancer, and the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology. And the history is that the college had a cooperative trials group funded by the NCI. It was called the American College of Surgeons Oncology Group. And with the reorganization of all the cooperative groups within the National Cancer Institute, the ACOSOG group merged with two other groups, the CALGB and the NCCTG, and they all became the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology. So as with that merger, Heidi Nelson, who is the chair of ACOSOG, had the vision that in order to get more surgeons involved in cooperative group trials, but also to develop other avenues of research, such as comparative effectiveness research and cancer care delivery research, implementation and dissemination research, and other areas like that that work, you know, well for some surgeons who aren't doing actually enrolling patients in clinical trials, she developed this program, and so now I've taken over in leading that group.
So Dr. Hunt, you're at one of the preeminent cancer centers in the world, and you're the head of breast surgery there. What projects are you most excited about or research that is ongoing in breast cancer surgery?
Well, there's so many projects. There's definitely not a lack of projects and a lack of trials. But, you know, one of the things that I've been most interested in over the past 5 to 10 years is trying to minimize the extent of axillary surgery that we do for patients with breast cancer. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is that the morbidity of the axillary surgery is probably the most significant morbidity that we see in our patients, and especially lymphedema. Patients who get lymphedema after axillary dissection, you know, they live with that for the rest of their life, and it can be a real issue in terms of quality of life for our patients. But the other reason is that we've learned so much about breast cancer biology, and we understand so much more about, you know, how to treat the disease from a systemic standpoint, that often we don't need that extensive local regional treatment in the care of patients. And so we really need to personalize how we do the surgery, when we do the surgery, and to what extent we do the surgery. So that's been one of my major efforts, both in clinical trials and then, you know, also in developing model systems for understanding which patients need what type of surgery.
So that actually, that transitions nicely into the next segment of the program, which we call our dissection of the day, which is where we delve more in depth about a specific topic. And since we have you on the show today, we were hoping to speak more about exactly what you were just speaking to, is decreasing the morbidity associated with the surgery. Certainly, we've come a long way since, you know, the days of Halsted with regard to breast surgery. And there seems to be a lot of emphasis right now on decreasing the morbidity, specifically with things like the axillary dissection. So we were hoping to talk more about that in our topic today.
Yeah. So Dr. Hunt, what, you know, these less is more type strategies to try to make the balance between preservation of function, lessen morbidity, but have the same oncological outcome, especially for those patients with early stage disease. Where is that right now, whether it be the targeted axillary dissection, or are we ever going to get to the point, do you think, that maybe there's a couple of biopsies alone and there's no surgery, there's no follow-on? Where are we at along this evolution, like most things, in different, even with different areas of the body?
Yeah, so that transition, I think we're definitely in a transition zone where there are going to be some patients in the very near future that we don't do any axillary surgery at all. And I think that especially in the subtypes like the HER2-positive breast cancers and even, you know, the triple-negative breast cancers, which are more aggressive subtype, as we start to identify the targets for therapy and those patients are getting neoadjuvant treatment before they have any surgery, I think we're definitely getting to a point where we'll do a biopsy, we'll figure out which target we need to treat for that patient, they'll get their systemic treatment, and then afterward, we'll do another biopsy and decide if we need to do any surgery at all for that patient.
And are you speaking to both clinically positive, node positive, and clinically node negative patients that undergo neoadjuvant therapy with that?
Yeah, so the clinically node positive and clinically node negative, that's a good way to sort of separate the patients out, as long as we have documentation of the clinically node positive disease. So one of the things that I think we've learned is that in the patients who are going to get neoadjuvant therapy, we do better if we assess the axilla for involvement after the neoadjuvant therapy, because if you compare patients stage for stage, patients who undergo surgery up front versus patients who have neoadjuvant systemic therapy and then have surgery afterward, you're going to have more positive nodes in the patients who have surgery up front, and you're going to that's going to require more axillary dissections. So there have been plenty of clinical trials that have done over the past few decades showing that systemic therapy not only decreases the size of the primary tumor, but it also eliminates metastases in the regional nodes. And so if we do the sentinel node surgery after chemotherapy, then, you know, we're going to have fewer positive nodes and need fewer axillary dissections. But in the clinically node-positive patients, that's where the sentinel node surgery has not had as much uptake because the false negative rates have been higher than what most people want to accept as a good staging tool. And so that's where the targeted axillary dissection has really come in. And Abigail Caudill and Henry Cure from our group here at MD Anderson have recently published on that technique whereby you put a clip in the node that you've biopsied, proven that's positive up front. And then after a chemotherapy, if the patient has had a clinical response, you know, we don't want to target patients who still have a lot of obvious gross disease, but if they've had a good clinical response to the systemic therapy, those are the ones that we're using sentinel node surgery with removal of the clipped node. And so that's why we call it a targeted axillary dissection. Yeah. And the false negative rates using that approach are really, really small. I mean, single percent range. So I think that's where we can be much more confident in our ability to stage the axilla and assess response. Because, of course, response to systemic therapy is also a very important parameter that we've defined, you know, over the years in looking at neoadjuvant trials. And now pathologic complete response is actually being used by the FDA to consider expedited drug approval in the neoadjuvant setting for breast cancer. So we want to be able to have accurate assessment of response. So our accuracy in terms of our surgical technique is going to be important in that.
Now, for those that are people out there listening, I think what you're speaking to is the Z1071, the NSABP B51, and the Alliance trial with regard to the clinically node positive patients and the role for sentinel lymph node versus axillary dissection. And remind me if I remember this correctly, but I think the false negative rate was somewhere in the range of the 10% to 15%.
Yeah, so for the Alliance B1071 trial, the false negative rate was 12.6%.
Right. Okay.
We had hoped that it would be 10% or less, and that is what we defined would be a positive trial, you know, that if the false negative rate was lower than 10%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But an important thing to learn about or to understand about the Z1071 trial is it was set up in such a way that patients could be registered at the beginning of their systemic treatment or at the end. So we were not allowed in the design of the trial to select patients only based on clinical response.
I see.
So again, if you have a patient who's got biopsy-proven node-positive disease and they get systemic therapy and then you assess them after their therapy and they still have abnormal nodes and, you know, obviously a disease that's more resistant and may have a higher disease burden there, then I think, you know, local regional therapy and how we do that is much different than those patients who have a really good response to therapy and have what appear to be negative nodes based on, you know, our imaging studies and other tools that we have to assess after chemotherapy.
Now, how good is the data then for the targeted axillary dissection in those patients? Is this something you're using in clinical practice, or are we still kind of in the beginning, you know, research and development phase of this?
Well, I think, you know, we're getting close to really being able to put it into practice. We would like to have, we've been doing it here for a couple of years at MD Anderson. We'd, of course, like to have more numbers just to support that. But again, what we've seen is that if you just use the sentinel node surgery alone, the false negative rate is going to be somewhere around 10%. We've over the years, we've been able to get that lower and lower by using ultrasound and other things to help select patients. But when we add the targeted axillary dissection, so we're confirming that we have the clipped node, and we use an I-125C to put in the clipped node so that we're sure that we're getting that clipped node out as part of the procedure. The false negative rates are just really, really low. So we hope to, you know, we have published some of our initial results. We hope to get more data out there because I think people want to see a larger data set. But it's definitely getting to a point where I think we're going to start being able to do that in practice. Now, of course, many people are starting to use sentinel node dissection after chemotherapy for lymph node staging based on the 1071 trial results, because what we found is that if you use dual techniques, so using both a radiolabeled material, usually that's technetium 99, and a blue dye together to do the sentinel node biopsy, then the false negative rate is much lower. And also, if you're certain that you recover all of the sentinel nodes, so usually there's two or three sentinel nodes. So in the setting where only one sentinel node is removed because you can't find any others, or you know, the patient sometimes only has one sentinel node, in that setting we found that the false negative rate was much higher. So right. you can get a more acceptable false negative rate by paying attention to the technical aspects of the procedure. So I think that's where surgeons can really, you know, do a better job with using that type of procedure for staging if they pay attention to those aspects of it.
Do you routinely use both the dye and the radiotracer?
Yeah, certainly in the neoadjuvant setting I do. Patients who are early stage who are undergoing upfront surgery, then, you know, I still prefer to use both the technetium and the blue dye together, because I think a lot of times I'm doing surgery in a situation where I have trainees, fellows, or residents or others with me, and it's really much easier to, I think, show the technique and really help the trainees learn the technique when you have dual agent mapping.
Can you talk a little bit more about, you mentioned the use of ultrasound, but how that's fitting into your operative plan or clinical practice with as far as staging the axilla, for instance, like the sound trial and how you use it?
Yeah, so in my practice, at my institution, we've been using ultrasound of the regional nodes for more than 20 years. And so before I came to MD Anderson, that was already a standard part of the practice. We had some very talented radiologists who really helped to stage the patients using ultrasound up front. And so we've always had in our practice, as part of the algorithm for a new patient evaluation, that the patient gets diagnostic mammography and has an ultrasound of the breast and the regional nodes. So that includes the axilla and the supraclav area and the internal mammary nodes as well. So we have done that for quite some time, and using fine needle aspiration, then confirming when a node looks abnormal based on the ultrasound. And they have specific sonographic criteria to define what's an abnormal node, what's a normal node. And that's been published by our group very recently as well. So when we see something that looks abnormal on ultrasound, they confirm it with fine needle aspiration or core biopsy. And then, then we put a clip in the node so that we can target that node later for intervention. So that's been our standard practice for a long time. After, the results of Z11, some people have suggested that perhaps we should not do ultrasound up front, because in those early stage patients that maybe only have one or two positive nodes, if they had sentinel node surgery first, they would be a candidate for treatment based on the ACOSOG Z11 trial criteria, whereby if they are planned for whole breast radiation, breast conserving surgery, and have just one or two positive sentinel nodes, that they might be able to forego axillary dissection. But what we've found in our practice is that actually the ones that we're identifying with ultrasound are larger volume disease and usually have more positive nodes than what's typical for the ACOSOG Z11 type patient. So for those patients, usually they're T1 tumors and, they're much smaller. Even all the T1s are much smaller, very small T2s that were included in that trial. And then also the disease burden in the nodes is much smaller. Some patients did have macro metastases on the Z11 trial, but many were micro metastases. And the patients that we're identifying with ultrasound are a larger burden of disease. So we are still using ultrasound to try to better stage the patients and understand what's going on when we first see them. Because usually if they have positive nodes at presentation, those are the ones that we would want to most likely use neoadjuvant approaches for their treatment, especially if they have the biologic subtypes like the HER2 positive or the triple negative. As far as the sound trial, that's an interesting trial because, they're really trying to ask the question, can we eliminate nodal evaluation at all? So like we were talking about a little bit earlier, that perhaps we don't need it for some subsets of patients. And so what they're doing is using ultrasound to try to define the clinical status of the axilla. And if it looks like it's negative, then the patient can be randomized to undergo sentinel node surgery or no sentinel node evaluation, and then just get the appropriate radiation and systemic therapy after they have removal of the primary tumor. So I think that's a really interesting question, and it's going to be a while before we get the results of that trial, but certainly going to be important information.
Okay, one quick question on that. Are any of these ultrasounds being performed and interpreted by surgeons?
Well, in the community, they are. In my institution, I'm in an academic center where we have a huge radiology group, and most of the patients, the vast majority of patients that I see already have a diagnosis of cancer. And so most of the time, I'm treating cancer patients. In the community, there are a lot of surgeons who see patients that don't have a diagnosis yet. So they're doing ultrasound in their office. Mm-hmm. And if they're trained in ultrasound, and, you know, there are several courses that you can take, and the American Society of Breast Surgeons has been a real leader in this area of getting surgeons trained in not just doing ultrasound, but also the interventional aspects of it, so targeting the areas for biopsy and demonstrating that they have the skills to do that well. And so in some places, surgeons are doing the ultrasounds themselves and doing the biopsies and putting the clips in and all aspects of that. So I think it just depends on what practice environment that you're in.
It's kind of how thyroid surgeons have kind of developed that skill over the past 10 years or so. Similar. One question for you. This is a dynamic question, but the role of tumor biology in surgical planning and adjuvant therapy, and are there any new markers being developed?
Well, yeah, there are a tremendous number of new markers that are being evaluated in breast cancer. And so the main one that's been, you know, that we've heard a lot about over the past decade or so is the HER2.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we have a lot of specific targeted agents now for HER2 positive breast cancer. But in the triple negative breast cancer subtype, that's where people are really mining the data in order to try to figure out what are the appropriate targets, because we call it triple receptor negative because there's no estrogen receptor, there's no progesterone receptor, and there's no HER2. But when you try to subtype these tumors using molecular techniques, what you find is that they do classify into different subgroups. And within those subgroups, you can find different pathways that are activated or inactivated. And so there are, you know, several areas. Androgen receptor is one. There's several other potential targets within these subtypes of triple negative breast cancer. And, we have, and as others do, we have several ongoing clinical trials now trying to look at novel agents targeting those specific pathways. So there's going to be a lot of really interesting information coming out over the next few years in terms of, you know, triple negative breast cancer, which has been uniformly a very challenging area to treat, very aggressive type of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Can we find specific treatments and turn it into something more like HER2-positive breast cancer, which years ago we didn't like to see HER2-positive breast cancer because we didn't have any specific treatments, but now it's an area that we're really excited about because we know we can cure many of those patients.
That's really interesting. How far down the road are we looking before we get to these type of treatments for the triple negative? Are we looking 15 years, you know, 10 years?
Well, you know, that was the traditional model of, you know, you find a target in the lab and then you test it in a preclinical model and then you put it into phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials. And it takes, you know, 10 to 15 years to see that. But, you know, now that's why I think we're so excited about the new neoadjuvant platform and the new FDA approach to using pathologic complete response as a surrogate marker and for improved outcomes and survival. So you can do smaller trials. You need fewer patients, and using that pathologic complete response as the endpoint, we can try to get these drugs into the treatment, you know, into the clinic faster. So I think we're seeing a shortened time frame. I don't know exactly what that, you know, really that time frame looks like now from identification in the lab to, you know, the first patient being treated after results of the clinical trial. But it's much shorter than 10 to 15 years now. Fortunately, it's a much shortened timeline.
Excellent. You know, getting back to a lot of the patients come to you with the diagnosis of cancer and they've already had their imaging studies. One of the things we're seeing a lot is, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, is perhaps the overuse of breast MRI. Oftentimes we'll see, you know, patients get referred to us who've had a diagnosis of DCIS, who've undergone, you know, bilateral breast MRI before they get to us, and then they've, you know, maybe seen some little lesion on the MRI and undergone further biopsies. And I was just wondering how you use breast MRI in your practice as far as your preoperative workup.
Yeah, so that is a really controversial area, the use of MRI in breast cancer. And in my practice, like I mentioned before, we use whole breast ultrasound in addition to mammography. And so with the use of ultrasound, we have not found that adding MRI is of any significant benefit on top of those two exams. So, you know, in the community, of course, there are places where people don't do whole breast ultrasound for screening and or for diagnostic evaluation, and so MRI might be more useful to them. The question is, you know, how often does the finding of some incidental focus of an additional disease in that breast make a difference in the outcomes? Mm-hmm. And are we really doing patients a favor by doing more mastectomies when we're finding these additional lesions? So this is actually the question in a clinical trial that's ongoing right now in the Alliance. It was just opened, I think, just about 6 months ago or so, and it's a collaboration with Akron, which is the diagnostic imaging network that's also funded through the NCI. It's now merged with ECOG, one of the other cooperative groups. So I think they're called ECOG Akron. But so this is a trial where patients who have breast cancer, and we're targeting HER2-positive and triple-negative breast cancers because those have traditionally a higher recurrence rate than the ER-positive breast cancers, which do very, very well with lumpectomy and radiation. So we're targeting those patients for randomization at diagnosis. So if you think the patient's a candidate for breast conservation, we're randomizing them to have an MRI or not, and then undergo their surgical treatment. And so what we're trying to see is how often does the MRI actually make a difference? How often do we find additional disease that changes the treatment algorithm? And, you know, what difference does that make in terms of long-term outcomes? And so that's an ongoing clinical trial. That's a question we're trying to answer. For the person who's seeing patients out in the community right now, I think it sort of depends on your practice situation and who you work with, you know, in terms of what kind of information you're going to get from ultrasound, if you want to use that, or MRI. I think the most difficult thing is when you get an MRI that's really not very good quality, mm-hmm. and then you end up having to repeat it or do several targeted ultrasound procedures to try to look for these you know, additional abnormalities and see if you can biopsy them versus doing MRI-guided biopsy. You know, so those are all very challenging areas, and it can really extend the time that it takes a patient to get diagnostic evaluation before they have surgical treatment when you have to introduce all these additional tests. And, it creates a lot of anxiety as well. And so there's a lot of publications out there in the literature over the last few years suggesting that the use of MRI is related to the increased mastectomy rates that we've been seeing. And so that's an area of concern, of course.
Shifting a little bit, could you just give us a brief overall definition of what oncoplastics is and how this has evolved and how it's used?
Well, I think oncoplastics is you know, basically meant to imply that the patient is having both the oncologic resection of the tumor and also reconstruction of the breast to try to optimize the cosmetic outcome. So the place where this has really been the most helpful, I think, is in those patients who have very large ptotic breasts where sometimes you want to do a lumpectomy, but the radiation oncologist feels that their breast size is too large. It's hard for them to treat that volume, and it sometimes causes increased skin toxicity in order for them to treat the whole breast mm-hmm. all the way to the chest wall and so forth. So in doing a reduction mammoplasty at the same time as the lumpectomy, that can help to reshape and resize the breast such that the patient can have a better outcome, both cosmetic outcome and also less toxicity related to the radiation delivery. and make the ease of radiation delivery something for the radiation oncologist, which can be, as I said, very challenging for a really large ectopic breast. So that was sort of how the field evolved. But now I think we use oncoplastics much more for patient with really any size breast, because we know that anytime we're removing volume from the breast, it's going to change the shape and size of the breast with respect to the opposite breast. And of course, breast symmetry is very important, because when patients wear clothing and do athletic things, they need to have symmetry, and it makes it easier for them to be able to buy clothing and bras and things if the breasts are symmetric. Yeah. So one of the things that we try to anticipate is what type of change in the breast shape and volume is there going to be based on the size of the lesion, but also based on the location. Because in the lower part of the breast, it's really challenging to remove any significant volume of tissue without really changing the shape of the breast and also the position of the nipple and things like that. So there are a lot of techniques that have been developed that are not necessarily reduction mammoplasty to that degree, but ways of remodeling the breast and moving tissue around from other parts of the breast in order to achieve the best cosmetic outcome. And we want to do that before radiation, because after radiation delivery, it's really hard to go in and do a procedure where you're going to be moving significant volumes of tissue around, because it does, the radiation delivery does impact the blood supply and the nature of the tissue, such that most plastic surgeons are not happy to do a significant amount of rearrangement of the breast tissue after radiation delivery. The complication rates are higher. There's more fat necrosis, more problems with infection, things like that. So I think the oncoplastic approach implies that you're trying to reshape and resize the breast before radiation to get optimal long-term outcomes.
So kind of a weird two-part question. One are these techniques, these oncoplastic techniques, something you see working their way into the practice of the general surgeon out there treating breast cancer, or should this, is that safe, number one? Or should this be reserved for, you know, more specialized breast centers? And two, how does all this play into breast surgery training? And are we going to see more general surgeons doing these techniques, or are we going to see more people getting referred to breast centers to have their surgery done?
Well, those are some great questions. I can say that it's really evolving now. I think there are general surgeons in practice who are doing these oncoplastic techniques. And similar to what we were talking about with ultrasound before, these are, in general, people who've gone to take courses. Many of our professional meetings, professional societies have annual meetings where there are courses that are full day or even longer showing different techniques and making sure that people are well trained to understand the different components of the procedure. So, for instance, the American Society of Breast Surgeons meeting is next month in May, and they have an oncoplastic course that you can sign up for and go to as part of that annual meeting. But, you know, that there is more emphasis on the surgical trainee learning about these techniques as well. So, for instance, we have a breast surgery fellowship. We have four fellows per year, and they spend 6 months doing breast surgical oncology with me and my colleagues in our group. But then they spend 6 months doing other rotations. They rotate with radiation oncology, medical oncology, pathology, and plastic surgery is one of their rotations as well. Mm-hmm. And in the plastic surgery rotation, of course, they're seeing some of the bigger flaps and bigger procedures, but they're also learning the fundamentals of, you know, breast reduction and mastopexy and other things that can help them to, provide or learn about oncoplastic surgery as well. So more and more breast surgeons are being trained in oncoplastic surgery. General surgeons are able to get training. And sometimes, you know, it's important for general surgeons to be able to do this because there's still a large number of patients who are treated in more remote areas that don't have access to plastic surgeons or don't have access to a breast center. And although, you know, we'd like to have the best quality of care for every single patient, it's not always feasible for patients to travel to centers and, you know, spend time at a remote location away from their family, away from their work, and so forth. Yeah. So I think we have to figure out ways of training that next generation and the people who are currently delivering care out in the community to make sure that patients have access to all of these.
Yeah, I think it's a problem many specialties are struggling with right now as things become more and more specialized. I kind of heard that reiterated from people from various specialties. Well, that was great. That was a great talk on a very broad and kind of overwhelming topic of breast cancer and a lot of useful information in there. So what we'd like to do now is the next segment, which is called Tips and Tricks, which is a segment where we address some of the more difficult clinical scenarios or difficult clinical decision-making algorithms. And for breast cancer, we were hoping that you could maybe talk to us a little bit about how you counsel a patient and how you approach maybe the younger patient who presents to you with a newly diagnosed breast cancer and she just happens to be pregnant.
Yeah, so that's a really challenging situation and always a lot of different things to consider because these are typically young women, of course, and so there's concern about not just about their treatment, but how it's going to impact their family and the baby. And so there's a lot of family planning considerations that need to be considered as the patient's being evaluated. But also, in younger women who have breast cancer, we also are concerned about the possibility of a genetic predisposition. And so we have to consider that in the patient's treatment and also in her family planning as well. In the past, we would really treat these patients with surgery, and there was a lot of consideration given about termination of the pregnancy because there was concern that the patient might have more aggressive, disease while being pregnant with breast cancer, and that the patient might not be able to get adequate treatment in that setting. But now we know that from studying this problem for a long time, that patients can actually receive systemic chemotherapy while they're pregnant very safely as long as they're beyond their first trimester. And again, in younger patients, we tend to see usually larger tumors and more aggressive disease. Often, you know, there can be a delay in diagnosis and so forth. And so when we see these patients at presentation, we try to do a clinical staging and understand, you know, what type of breast cancer they have. Of course, you know, the biologic subtype, we try to understand what the extent of the disease is and whether it's just in the breast or in the regional nodes and so forth. And then we look at, well, what is their treatment going to be overall? If they're going to need systemic treatment based on the biologic subtype and the stage and so forth, then usually we would want to go ahead and do that while they're pregnant. We know that what agents they can receive safely, and then we can complete their systemic treatment, plan the delivery of the child based on the timing of when they complete their treatment, and then do the surgical management following the systemic therapy. This also helps because in patients who want to consider breast conservation, of course they can't receive radiation therapy during pregnancy, but if they are getting their chemotherapy and then they do a lumpectomy after they deliver the baby, then they can have the radiation following the surgery. So it helps with, sequencing the treatments. And then also if we're going to consider doing genetic testing because of the young age and certainly some of the biologic subtypes like triple receptor negative breast cancers have a higher incidence of BRCA mutations. And so those are individuals that we would want to do genetic testing on. And in those cases, most likely we would recommend mastectomy as opposed to breast conserving surgery. And so having the treatment up front and then doing surgery later allows this for the patient to complete their term of pregnancy and then deliver the baby and then do surgical treatment, which would usually be mastectomy for a BRCA mutation carrier, and have reconstruction and other parts of their care as needed.
And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to add on one extra question of the tips and tricks unrelated to the breast cancer during pregnancy. Can you just give us a quick guideline for patients that we should be considering for neoadjuvant therapy?
Okay, well, yeah, that's a good question. So really the data on trials comparing neoadjuvant versus adjuvant systemic therapy in breast cancer have not shown any difference in long-term survival, whether you do the neoadjuvant treatment first or you do it after the surgery. So just from the survival perspective, there's not any difference there. But using neoadjuvant therapy allows for assessment of response, which pathologic complete response is a very strong prognostic indicator. And also, we see with most breast cancers, we see substantial shrinkage in the primary tumor size, then that allows for breast conservation in a lot of patients. And then also we see a reduced number of positive lymph nodes after neoadjuvant therapy. So again, that allows us to consider doing less surgery in the axilla. And so for all those reasons, assessment of response, decreasing the size of the primary tumor, decreasing the incidence of positive lymph nodes, we will consider a patient for neoadjuvant therapy if, based on the biologic subtype and stage, we know that we're going to recommend systemic treatment for that patient. So, it's a multidisciplinary treatment decision, but generally that means HER2-positive breast cancers, triple-negative breast cancers, really of size greater than, 1 to 2 centimeters, are most likely going to receive systemic treatment as part of their therapy. And then the tricky area is those patients that have ER-positive breast cancers that don't have HER2 positivity as well, because ER-positive breast cancers, in the past, we used to recommend systemic chemotherapy based on tumor size, but now we understand that ER-positive breast cancers can have different biologic behaviors, and there are some commercially available tests like the 21 gene recurrence score assay where we can test the tumor, and if it's a low recurrence score, even if it's a relatively large size tumor, say 2 or 3 centimeters in size, that patient really will not need systemic chemotherapy or probably won't benefit from systemic chemotherapy and can just have endocrine therapy alone. So for the ER positive subtype, those are ones where we really have to consider whether we should do surgery first, because that might help us avoid any systemic chemotherapy and just treat them with endocrine therapy.
Right. Right. That's great. That's all very good stuff. And that does it for our tips and tricks segment.
Okay, man, we're going to end the day out with our final five. We've been asking all of our experts 5 quick, lighthearted questions to end the episode and get to know them a little bit better. If we were to look into your iPod right now, what was the last song that was played, and do you play music in the operating room?
Well, yes, I do play music in the operating room, and yesterday I was listening to Coldplay. I've always liked that, so I can't remember which song was last played, right, but it was a long list. So.
Number 2, do you have any hobbies or talents or special interests outside of the OR that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah, well, my husband and I really like sports a lot, so I spend a lot of time at sporting events, especially NBA and NFL. But also I play tennis and I run and like to exercise a lot, and I really enjoy yoga. So those are all fun things that awesome. I like to do.
Can you take us back to one of your most memorable vacations or trips?
Well, recently, just a couple weeks ago, my husband surprised me with an anniversary trip to Paris, France.
Oh, nice. Oh, wow.
And so that was pretty awesome, pretty amazing. And I had so many great trips, but I can't think of anything that really tops that. We had a great time.
Awesome. Well, hopefully your husband's listening. Number four, if you weren't a surgeon, if you didn't go into surgery, what else would you be doing? What career path would you have chosen?
Yeah, I've thought about that really, really a lot, because sometimes after a long day in the OR, you might be kind of tired and thinking, wow, can I really do this forever? But it's hard to think of something else that I would rather do. But I've always enjoyed teaching, so whether it's teaching trainees or teaching, I do a lot of speaking around the world and around the country. And whenever I do have an opportunity to share information and new knowledge and talk with people, I really get, you know, quite excited about that. So I probably would have been in teaching to some in some degree.
Okay, the final question. If you could go back and talk to yourself on your first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Basically, just hang in there, because it's scary and it's tough. And, you know, the other thing is I learned early on that, you know, don't be afraid to ask people for help, like the nurses. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the first experiences I had was a really sick patient in the ICU, and I got called to take care of the patient, and the nurse said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, what do you usually do? And she was great, because she shared with me what, you know, algorithm she would have, she's followed in what she's seen and what works, and we worked together and took care of the patient. And so I think that's the best thing you can do, is don't be afraid to ask for help and work with your colleagues.
Well, thanks. That was just that was awesome. We really appreciate your time. We know your time is valuable, and we thank you for being with us on Behind the Knife.
All right, thank you.
Well, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. Special thanks to Dr. Hunt and her sharing with us her expertise as it comes to breast cancer and approaching the axilla. Join us next time as we delve into the depths of surgery with another exciting guest.
And we really want you guys to interact with us. Hit us up on Twitter at Behind the Knife. Find us on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. And we really need you guys to subscribe on iTunes. It helps get us up in the ranking. And write us some reviews. And actually, go to our website. And if you have a comment on the episode and you want to discuss, or questions that were unanswered, let us know, and we'll get those addressed for you.
All right. Well, it looks like the count is correct. The fascia is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, dominate the day.